you've heard of Tom's Diner, right? It's a diner that's been around since the 1940s. It sits in my neighborhood in New York City, at the corner of Broadway and 112th Street, just a couple of blocks from Columbia University. And it's no ordinary diner. It became famous in the 1980s because Suzanne Vega, she wrote a song about it called Tom's Diner. Barack Obama was a regular at the diner when he was a student. Tom's has this red-orange neon restaurant marquee. It's recognizable to Seinfeld fans all over the world. You'll always see tourists outside taking selfies in front of the sign. And whenever I'm in the diner, I do find myself watching the faces of those tourists when they walk into Tom's because they look, well, confused. Because Tom's Diner inside looks nothing like the Seinfeld set where Jerry, Elaine, George, and Kramer would sit and talk about nothing. Tom's is dark, cramped. The wood panel booths, they bear the scars and scuffs of decades of Columbia students. As the tourists take their seats in one of those booths, I see their beaming smiles become tentative, awkward half-smiles because their perception of what they saw on the outside is merging with the reality that they are now sitting in. But I don't come to Tom's to just gawk at the tourist. I come to think. Tom's is my thinking place. It was actually a location in the finale episode of season 2 of this podcast, because Tom's is where I decided, it was almost 2 years ago, to tell my story of what happened to me at the Goodspeed Opera House while working as a lead actor in their production of Billy Elliot the Musical. Today, on New Year's Day 2024, I find myself sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. The place is packed. I'm at the counter, perched between two cake stands. There's a half of a pound cake to my left and a big stack of corn muffins to my right. And in front of me, I have an 8x10 folder stuffed with printed up emails and Instagram messages. When we aired the finale episode back in August of last year of what went down at the Opera House, I thought that would be the end of it, except for a few bonus episodes here and there. But the emails and the messages, they just kept coming from listeners. And so, over a New York diner cup of coffee, I'm reading the stories of actors who felt seen and heard in my podcast story. It was a story that covered a lot of failures in the workplace. Unsafe working conditions, failure to supervise a vengeful coworker, an abusive producer, an emotionally manipulative director, and retaliation by management for speaking up. But there was one key figure in my own story that resonated with many of you, the listeners. At the top of my folder, I have a bunch of pages clipped with a post-it note on top. And I've written on it, Stage Manager Stories.
I'd never experienced a stage manager that was that toxic.
Rather than stopping and seeing how we could fix this, they allowed us to flop around that stage. We were repeatedly told what a horrible job we did.
It felt horrific. I would arrive at the theater and walk in the stage door and my stomach would drop.
It made me want to be done with the show as soon as possible.
And so I was panicked.
I developed 5 autoimmune disorders due to my experience with a stage manager, and there was no help for me. There was no one I could turn to.
Bad people need to be called out.
I'd say especially a stage manager, actually, because of the position they have that is central to all of the figures.
I just was like, how are we all okay with this? How are we all okay with this?
In this 2-part episode, we're listening to the stories of 3 Broadway actors who, in front of the curtain, looked like they had booked the job of their dreams. But behind the curtain, it was a different story. Three actors who say one powerful person backstage changed their lives with the power of words. I'm Sean Hayden, and you're listening to episode 1 of season 3 of Stage Combat. How are we all okay with this?
In the moments where you described what had happened, when you found out, or even behind the scenes, the inner workings that you didn't know were happening, I would gasp, or I would even shout out loud, like, who said this was okay? What are they doing?
That's Taylor Mazaros, a listener who wrote into us. But Taylor isn't an actor. She's actually a union stage manager in Pittsburgh. In fact, Taylor is one of many stage managers who wrote to us after listening to my stage manager story in seasons 1 and 2 of this podcast.
That was the moment that I gasped when the stage manager was submitting the report on the night that you had your panic attack.
The show report.
Yeah, the show report. And it said no notes.
Good show.
Nothing of note.
Yeah. Why was that shocking to you?
Because to me, that is perhaps the most untruthful thing you can say.
Yeah, it's the power of words.
Every episode, I think I was working a show during the time, and I would go and I was like, you've got to listen to this, but you will not believe what this stage manager did. So yeah.
And that's another one of our listeners, Natasha Jackson from Raleigh, North Carolina, who is also a union stage manager. Natasha, let's talk about what a stage manager does. In season 1, I sort of described a stage manager like an air traffic controller of a live theatrical production. Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with that. I actually often refer to the stage manager as the hub of everything, because everything comes to the stage manager. The sound designer, when they're finished, that comes into the stage manager. The light designer, that comes through. You work closely with the director, the assistant director, the producer. Then you also have to deal with the actors. And of course, once the show opens, it's your show.
Natasha, once the show opens, you know, as the actor, we're not interacting with the director because the director's gone. We're not regularly interacting with management. It's the stage manager that's really at the center of everything for us.
Completely, completely. And so I see part of the stage manager role as someone who sets the tone. And so I make sure before I go into the space, I'm in the right headspace for myself. And then when I go, I speak to everyone. You know, I ask them, how was your day? So that I know that whether it is showtime or rehearsal, they are in the mental space I need them to be in order for the show, the rehearsal, whatever, to be successful. I've heard stories, not just from your podcast, but I've heard stories where the tone that they set is not a healthy one.
Here's stage manager Taylor again.
I view part of my job as a stage manager caring for the entire team and making sure everybody feels safe, supported, and heard. How terrifying must it be to be an actor who knows that the stage management team doesn't have your back? That's terrifying.
So what does happen backstage when it doesn't feel like your stage manager has your back? What happens when you find yourself working in what seems to be a culture of fear? And what is the effect on your health and your well-being? Meet Brett Shuford and Brad Bass, two Broadway actors in 2 different Broadway shows.
And it was the kind of situation where it was like, I don't think I ever want to do this again. And I know a lot of people who have done that same show as a long-running show on Broadway, who have actually done that. They said, I did that show and I quit the business because of their experience there.
That's Brett. And for him, it was a show he booked in 2019. It was the blockbuster musical Wicked, a show that has grossed over $5 billion worldwide and has been running on Broadway for over 20 years.
So my first Broadway show was Wicked, and I saw a lot of things that I knew that shouldn't be going on that were going on. I saw people being mistreated.
And that's Brad. And after performing in Wicked, Brad booked a job in 2011 with another blockbuster Broadway show, Jersey Boys.
But really, when I booked Jersey Boys and I joined that company, that's when I became the target of the stage manager. That's when my spirit completely was broken. And that's truthfully when my life changed, because I decided to leave this business that I had loved for so long. I decided to leave it behind and move from New York City and change my life.
Brad grew up in a small town in Virginia, a place where he didn't quite fit in.
I lived on a farm where everybody played football, baseball, basketball, and I just wanted to do cartwheels and sing songs. When I found The Wizard of Oz as a kid, it was like, I don't know, it was like my everything. I didn't watch all the other movies the kids did. I watched The Wizard of Oz on repeat because I had taped it on our VCR, you know, because it would come on like once a year. And I would watch it, I mean, daily. And I'd come home from school and I would play every character throughout the whole movie, including Toto. And it was my everything.
But Brad would find a place where he did belong, New York City. And he would fulfill that love for playing characters on theater stages.
And at 18, I moved to New York and went to acting school and wanted to pursue my career of making my dreams come true and being on Broadway, and started working immediately, worked regionally, did lots of summer stocks, did tours, and then I booked my first of three Broadway shows.
Brett arrived in New York City from Beaumont, Texas. He was 20 years old. And like Brad, he soon found success on Broadway. But one show would open, a show would close. He met his husband, Stephen. And what Brett and Stephen desperately wanted was to have a child through surrogacy.
I had this capacity to love someone, love and raise a child in a way that I saw people, I saw my family and my brothers raising children with no intention, with no consciousness. And I knew that I could consciously parent and bring someone up in the world with a sense of love and service that to me really meant more than anything I had done.
Brett and Stephen needed a steady income so they could afford to have a child through surrogacy. And the answer to their prayers seemed to come in 2019 when Brett booked Wicked.
Booking a long-running show, we felt, would give us the stability and the income to support the journey of having a child and even getting that child through the first few years of their lives.
Both Brad and Brett were hired in their shows to be swings. Swing is an actor whose job it is to cover multiple roles and to be ready to go on for any one of them at a moment's notice. Brett's job was to cover 9 roles in Wicked, while Brad covered 7 roles in Jersey Boys, and they each met the actor they were replacing.
He told me, he said, "I can't take this anymore." I mean, I'm the newbie coming in going like, I feel sorry for this guy. He must not be good at his job. This is what my mind is thinking. But he was like, "I can't take it anymore. The pressure here, I feel like I can't do anything right. I just have to leave." And I'm like, "Oh, are you going to another show?" And he was like, "No, I would rather not have a job than do this job."
And I was like, "I don't understand why you would leave this job." I was like, "This is like a government job and you're making great money and you're so good in it." And he was like, "You'll find out." And so he, as he was hugging me on his way out, he said, "Make sure you start recording your note sessions with the stage manager." There's definitely a culture in that building of, it's a machine.
The whole production is a machine, is what you mean.
The show is a machine. And if you don't operate as a cog in that machine and it doesn't work perfectly, you're failing the entire machine and you're subject to be kicked out. And that's how it felt the whole time.
A few weeks after starting his job, Brett noticed something seemed to malfunction with the machine over at Wicked.
And then I get backstage for the next part of the number where there's a whole lineup of the entire ensemble. And the girl standing next to me is crying. And she's like, what was that? Who was that? I'm so scared.
Turns out this person, some crazy, you know, person from Times Square, ran into the building being chased by the cops. And the cops lost him. He ran into the Gershwin, up the escalator, through the lobby, past the box office, into the house, down the aisle, onto the stage, and into the wings. And two stagehands pinned this guy upstage at the psych while no one stopped the show. No one stopped the show.
You're kidding me.
So it turns out this guy and these two stagehands were blocking the entire upstage crossover for half of Act One, waiting for the cops to arrive. And it wasn't until Elphaba was up in the sky, belting out Defying Gravity, that we were all watching in the wings as the NYPD finally escorted this guy out the stage door.
Meanwhile, this guy could have had a knife or a gun or something, and he's, you know, on stage.
What did that tell you when they didn't stop the show?
They don't care about us. They don't care about us. The show is the most important thing.
Did you feel like other cast members felt the same about that moment?
100%. At intermission, there was a meeting and the stage manager, she was very flustered and, you know, feeling called out and whatever. And she said, this was my decision. I made this decision.
Over at Jersey Boys, Brad met his stage manager.
So I join, and the stage manager there, she made me feel like I was the present she had been wanting to get forever, because upon first meeting her, told me how excited she was to have me because she couldn't wait to get rid of the guy that I was replacing. Now, in the moment, I didn't realize how horrible that was. All I felt was like, thank God I'm here to rescue you and make you feel better.
Brad fairly quickly found out what the guy he was replacing was talking about. And it started with some mysterious tracking notes.
So they were specifically rehearsing me for one track that they knew I would go on for first. And I thought I had incredible support from my PSM.
PSM, that stands for the production stage manager, or the stage manager.
So I arrive, and my PSM, I had never experienced this before, had all these printouts to give me for all my tracks. And I thought, oh, I thought I was supposed to make my own Bible. We call it a Bible for each track. So the papers that she gave me would have things on it like, you enter stage left, you put on a chair, you exit stage right, you put on this costume for the next song. It's like a map, essentially. It's a map of what I had to do in the show. So I start learning this track that she's mapped out for me. Eventually, I go on for the first time. And so as I move through these tracks, it becomes very clear to me that the pages are not up to date. Okay, because I'm running to my dresser going, oh, she says that I wear glasses in this scene. And my dresser's like, you don't have glasses in this scene. So I go on stage without glasses and I get called to stage management and I get berated for not doing what's on the sheets that she had given me. And I said, I know it says this on the sheet, but the dresser is telling me that I don't have glasses. So I don't know what to do.
Brad soon discovered what was the issue with the tracking sheets.
These sheets had not been updated properly since the La Jolla production, which was the pre-Broadway production. And the show had been running on Broadway at this point for like years. So this is where the friction started to happen with her. She doesn't like people questioning her.
What was her response when you tell her that what's on the sheet is not what's being done on stage?
Her response was, you are to do what's on these pages. Even though they were wrong, according to my dresser and everybody else.
So your boss has given you a roadmap to do your job. She's telling you you must follow the map, but the map is flawed.
The pages are flawed, exactly.
Back at Wicked, Brett became sick. He caught one of the early cases of COVID before they were actually identified in the U.S. as COVID cases. But Brett clearly had flu-like symptoms. And he didn't have health insurance. That meant he felt he couldn't afford to call out sick.
You're working your Broadway show, and yet we're still in a union system where we have to collect enough weeks working at any theater to get our health insurance.
Correct. I don't want to call out because I need the weeks and I need the money, and they don't have anybody else to cover these parts. And I feel like the show must go on. You know, that culture that we've all been taught, like I have to just push through. So I'm on like antibiotics, I'm on prednisone. As I went to the doctor, I'm just trying to like push through to do these shows, and they call a rehearsal and I'm just foggy, like the prednisone and everything. So I'm fumbling for some of my lines in this rehearsal. I was very, very sick. It was embarrassing, but I also felt horrible. But by the end of the rehearsal, it was great. I feel like I know this finally.
Later that night, the stage manager calls Brett to her office.
And she shuts the door and she says, "What was that today? That rehearsal today? Like, why? What was that about?" And I was like, "I know, I'm just sick and I'm trying to push through." And I felt like by the end of the rehearsal, I felt like really solid and I felt like I needed it. And so I really appreciated that we had the rehearsal. Well, it was unacceptable. It's unacceptable for you to show up a rehearsal like that. That night, I get home, I get an email. She wrote me up.
Getting written up by the stage manager is the kiss of death in a show. It's a disciplinary warning on your record with a union. And if warnings accumulate, then they could cost you your job. No one wants to be written up.
I've never been written up in 25 years of doing this. And she CC'd casting, she CC'd company management, she CC'd all the equity people, the entire creative team were all on the email with the letter.
How did that make you feel?
I mean, it was humiliating. I confronted her about it 2 weeks later. I had to put in for that principal role that I actually was sick at the rehearsal, and like I had my put in for it. Killed it, right? And she even says to me afterwards, like, "I have no notes for you. That was so great." And I said, "Great. Well, then can I ask you, why did you write me up?"
And what does she say?
"Oh, well, that's just protocol. That's just what we do." And it turns out, I think there's some stage managers, this one particular person included, who see it as a paper trail. But it's not a paper trail to protect us, it's to protect her. It's literally like, I need to write him up in case he tries to tell people when they call him on his day off that I'm bullying him.
Back in Jersey Boys, Brad had been watching the show backstage to learn his tracks with that flawed roadmap given to him by his stage manager. And now it was time for him to start understudy rehearsals under the watchful eye of the stage manager.
So I'm taking my notes. I had a, you know, one of those little iPad things with a typewriter, and I've created all my stuff. And so I decide I'm going to start doing what I'm seeing happening on stage every night, because that's clearly what I need to do, because that's how everything is set. Well, we have these understudy rehearsals and I start doing what I've been tracking. And she just, I'll never forget the first time she gave everybody notes at this understudy rehearsal. So it was all the swings, all the understudies. And I didn't get a note. And I was like, finally, like, I'm nailing this. And she dismissed everyone and said, "Everyone's free to go except Brad. We're going to have our session now." And she proceeded to absolutely tear me apart about what a horrible job I was doing and how she had given me everything that I needed to do my job. And I'm like, frozen, because I don't know what to do here. I don't want to argue with her. I just want to arrive and do my job well. So this keeps happening. I mean, every week, and we rehearsed every week, every week. I quickly felt like everything was unraveling because I kept being pulled aside after everybody else had been given their notes and dismissed, and sat with her, and she just talked to me like I was a dog, an absolute dog.
And then what did you actually do? Because you knew you would be doing things that were going to clash with what was happening on stage with the other actors.
I tried to like walk a tightrope of, you know, doing what she asked and doing what was on these sheets. I felt like I was almost being targeted. Like there was a target on my back. Truthfully, I felt like I was a mental case because I'm reading the sheet. I'm going to my dresser and they're saying two different things. It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy.
And all through your time there, is she still maintaining that same position to do what's on her tracking sheets?
Yeah. And eventually I remember her saying to me something like, well, I guess you're just going to do it your way. And I was like, none of this is my way. I'm trying to do what my job is. And you're telling me one thing and they're telling me one thing. And I'm sitting in the middle going, how do I ever win at this?
Back at Wicked, Brett recovered from COVID. And the stage manager wanted to put Brett into the show for one of his last remaining tracks.
The stage manager came to me and said, we can't give you a proper spacing rehearsal on stage because we don't have time.
A spacing rehearsal is an opportunity for the actor to actually run through the traffic on stage about a half an hour before the curtain goes up. This is really important in a show with a large cast, with big sets, automation, where a lot of things are happening on the stage all at once.
And so to do a performance with no spacing rehearsal is pretty courageous, I guess I would say.
Do you think it's potentially dangerous?
It can definitely be dangerous because you've got a person on stage who's never been in that situation. I think it's risky, right? I guess that's what I would say. It's risky.
Did you feel like you had any, were comfortable enough given the power dynamic to say, you know what? I would like a spacing rehearsal before I do that.
I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel like I could. Mm-hmm. I felt like there was this pressure. It was like, well, if I said no, then am I really right for this job?
And how did the show go that night?
That first night I went on with no spacing rehearsal, honestly, considering I thought it went good, I had no confidence. I probably was like a deer in headlights the whole time. There were two moments where I was like early on an entrance. And then there was another moment where it was a traffic issue where I went through the wrong people, but it was so fast. And I remember like noting, okay, great. But we got through it. Everything was fine. The show was fine. And then I got a text, come to the office.
It was the stage manager. She wanted to see Brett.
My heart was racing. I felt so on the spot. I felt like I had just climbed Mount Everest. You know, I just did something really challenging. And I'm told what a disaster I was.
Everest City was a disaster tonight. You know that, right? You bumped into people. That's a disaster in life.
I didn't think it. Okay.
I want to know if you know what you did wrong. And after this, I don't know what... I'm at the point now where I'm getting really frustrated.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you exactly how I feel.
Okay.
I feel like you are not doing your homework. I feel like I don't know what more to say to you about trailing and watching and going down on stage and running shows in your head with your headphones on. I don't know what more I can say to you. I feel like you're looking at this job like it's not that big a deal.
I hear you. I just want to say, I think the expectations are based on people who have done this show before.
No, I'm not using that as an excuse for you.
I can't think of a single stage manager on Broadway who would hire a swing who's never been in the show before, who is primarily a character actor now and does 8 tracks, who would not be like, thank God I have this person here. And she's sitting here telling me what a disaster I was. And there was this one moment. This was the moment where I was like, what is happening? When she said to me,
you've been here almost 6 months.
I've been here 3 months.
You've been here since November.
3 months.
November to December, December to January, January to February. Okay, 3 months. You've been here 3 months.
Was I remember there were other stage managers in the office, the assistant stage managers, and this is so vivid to me. When I said, I have not been here 6 months, they stood up, walked out of the room and shut the door.
Why did they do that?
Because I was challenging her.
And this is an environment where you don't challenge that stage manager?
I mean, it's what it seemed like to me. Instead of coming to my defense or helping diffuse the situation in some way, everyone just left me in the room with this person.
Listen, I went through the show twice in my apartment today. I mean, it doesn't matter how many times this track is not in any of the tracks near anything I've done previous.
Absolutely.
And so I trailed, I watched, but it doesn't make a difference until when I see 20 human beings coming at me. It makes a huge difference than doing it in a studio and doing it in my apartment. And this is the only track we have not done spacing rehearsal for.
I know. I understand that also.
So I thought I could pull through.
This is what I need for you. Okay. And you lead the rehearsal.
Yes.
That is the only way we're going to know whether you're ever going to get this.
Okay.
Okay. So that's number one. Number two, I need you again to be pro-fucking-active. If you need something, I don't know how many more times I can tell you this. I am not going to seek you out. How many times do I have to say that? And are you hearing me?
Yes.
I don't know what more we can do for you.
And I remember she was like, do you need another spacing rehearsal? You know, can you do the show again tomorrow?
Do you think you can do this without a spacing rehearsal tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. That's all I need to know.
And I knew that if I didn't say yes, she was probably going to write me up without telling me, right? Or call the creative teams and tell them he sucks, right? So my reputation's on the line. So I said, yes, it's fine. I can do it.
Which is not really what you wanted to say.
Well, honestly, what I wanted to say was I quit. It just wasn't worth it, you know? And then I got home that night and I was so distraught. I mean, I was like, I think I'm getting emotional just thinking about it.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it.
What are you feeling right now?
Grief. Like, I'm just so sad from that person, for me, for like that person who was so happy and excited and saw like a future for himself doing that show. And like, all we wanted was to be dads. Like, that was the only thing I wanted, was to be able to pay for a surrogacy so that we could raise a child. And I thought that was going to be the job that was going to give me that. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment I realized, like, this isn't going to give me that. And that's all I fucking wanted. And so I was panicked. I was like, I think I slept for an hour that night. I couldn't sleep. I was so distraught and I was so scared about going on and screwing up in some way.
And is the thought going through your mind that if I make a mistake, I'm going to get written up again and I'm on a path to being fired from the show?
I honestly, all I could think about at that time was I just don't want to get called back into the office.
Brett went back on stage for that same track.
And of course it was perfect. Like, I didn't mess anything up. But I'm in the wings. I'm exhausted. I haven't slept. And people are saying, are you okay? And I would say, no. I'm being bullied by the stage manager. And the complicitness that I experienced backstage, where everyone was just sort of like, yeah, that's how it is here. Welcome. I just was like, how are we all okay with this? How are we all okay with this?
The pandemic shut down Broadway several weeks later. Brett moved to Houston. And when Broadway opened up again, he heard from his agent. The producers asked Brett to return to the show. But Brett never went back. In Jersey Boys, things finally came to a head for Brad.
So what a lot of people might not know is that some of the actors in Jersey Boys play the guitar, right? Some of them are hired to play their tracks, to play guitar in scenes. When the swings go on, we don't play the guitar, right? Like, we pretend to play it, but someone in the orchestra pit is playing it. So I've learned how to do fingerings on a guitar. I've learned how to like fake a guitar. So when I was in my private note session with her, after she had let everybody else go, she said to me, and I don't like having to say these words on your podcast, but what these are the words she said to me verbatim was, "You played the guitar like a retard." And I was so taken aback by that, because who even talks like that or says that to someone else? And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Like this, just like that."
It looks like you're imitating someone trying to imitate a mentally challenged person. Is that what you were seeing?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
The person that is supposed to have my back, that is supposed to guide me, that is supposed to uplift me, this is what they said to me. And I went home in tears that day because I thought, oh my God, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to do my job well for this person. And I called Equity on her because I didn't know what to do.
And what did Equity, your union, what did your union tell you?
Well, they told me that they could do a few things, that they could really make a, I don't think they use the word stink, but they could make a situation where they called us and like had a mediation moment. And that terrified me because I was like, I don't want her to know that it was me that called her in. I just want her to be reprimanded because her behavior is inappropriate. I ended up calling Equity on her twice and nothing ever really happened.
What did it feel like for you to go to work each day?
Oh, it felt horrific. I would arrive at the theater and walk in the stage door and my stomach would drop, you know, because I never knew if I was going to be able to deliver that day because I felt like I couldn't do my job properly because I was always in fear that I was going to be reprimanded in a negative way. That's the truth.
Seems like even many years later, you're still feeling some of that.
Yeah, this was really difficult for me. I took a lot of pride in my work. I worked hard to be a good actor and to be reliable and to be kind. I've always been kind in this business. And my experience with her really, I mean, I had issues for years after I left the show. That's the reason I quit acting. I mean, I had nightmares. It sounds ridiculous, but I had nightmares about me like being told I'm going on for a track I don't even cover and her being there and her screaming at me.
It doesn't sound ridiculous. You heard about my nightmares from a regional production. It's not ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's real.
Even after all the time that I had spent being mistreated and being in fear and feeling less than, even though I was so far gone from it, away from performing, I still gave her so much power in my mind. You know what I mean? I think that's what feels ridiculous, but I understand that is trauma. Yeah. That is trauma living inside me.
Yeah. You know, it is trauma. I'm sorry you went through all that.
And I'm sorry you went through it too. But I can tell you something. If I ever witnessed that kind of behavior, I would never stand for it. I would never allow it to happen to anybody else. I would never allow it. I'm at the point in my life where I would make sure that that was stopped in an instant. And you know, when I left the show, I had decided I was leaving New York, and a bunch of my friends from the show and the two other ASMs from the show all came to dinner and they both apologized to me because they knew what was going on. They saw what was going on. And they felt like even they couldn't speak up and try to right the wrongs that she was doing. And I understood. I mean, I understood. She instilled fear.
Back at Tom's Diner on New Year's Day, the crowd is starting to clear out. And I'm left with the notes of Brett and Brad's stories in front of me. Two stories happening in two different shows, but I'm struck by the similarities between them. In the right margin of the page of my notes, I've written what Brad told me. She instilled fear. I decided I needed to make some sense of all of this. And to do that, I needed to contact a friend of the podcast.
Dr. Elisa Hurwitz, it's Sean Hayden with Stage Combat. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Hurwitz, you were the clinical psychologist who was the voice of reason for so many of our episodes in the first two seasons of the podcast. Did you get the notes about the two guys, that I sent you?
I did.
So I have a question for you. What the f*** is going on with these stage managers?
Coming up on the next episode of Stage Combat, how are we all okay with this? Part 2.
My physical, emotional, and spiritual life took precedence over being in a Broadway show. That's it. You know, this was my dream. And it's a crime what these people do to shatter these dreams.
Hey, welcome back, Stage Combat listeners, to season 3 of the podcast. The conversation for this episode continues over on Patreon in our exclusive Backstage Pass content. Hear more of my chat with stage manager Taylor and her personal take on the stage manager story at the Goodspeed Opera House.
When you had a panic attack and you're in the wings and the assistant stage manager is with you and the question, can you finish, comes out.
Can you do the finale?
Yeah. I sat there and thought, why on earth is that an option? This can't happen. This is unsafe. We have an emergency.
Plus, at Patreon, you can enjoy our all-new Stage Combat podcast series, which have been created exclusively for the Stage Combat community. There's our acting podcast, Just Acting, our mental health podcast called The Mental Health Pod, and Stage Combat Director's Commentary, where we spill the tea on what got left out in the original Goodspeed story the first time around. Just follow the link in the show notes to get your Backstage Pass over at Patreon. And remember, if you believe in the work we are doing at Stage Combat and our advocacy to bring about real change in the industry, your membership at Patreon is what enables us to continue to do that work. Just a reminder, the information in this podcast is not medical advice. Please seek the advice of a medical and/or a mental health professional. This episode was edited by Alex Griffith. Mixing and sound design were by Justin Garish. And it was hosted and directed by me, Sean Hayden. I hope today and every day brings you an opportunity to claim your story. Stage Combat is a production of Haywood Productions, LLC.